But he is finding ways of making me uncomfortable. A new way every chapter, it feels.
New way every chapter. You're getting just a little bit more uncomfortable.
That's tough to do. I'm usually impressed if a book can make me uncomfortable in one way by the end of it. But getting a new one every chapter, wow, that's reaching high.
Yeah.
Reaching high.
Yeah. You know what else is reaching high?
What's that?
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Pixelit. My name is Kevin. With me, as always, is Phil. And on today's show, part two of Sacred and Terrible Air by Robert Kurvitz. I mean, we're going through it.
We're doing it. We've been talking about this since basically the beginning of this show. This is one of those, like, a lot of these books and stuff and adaptations we've discovered along the way.
Right.
This was one of those early on ones that was like, if we could, because at the time, a couple of years back, this was not such an easy thing.
Yeah,
to find.
It wasn't like the translation that you should use wasn't super obvious the time, and now it is, and
thank god
we are exposing ourselves to this. Now it's here's the thing, it's good in a way that, but it's also like, okay, when I finished Blood Meridian, my wife asked me, did you like it? Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know if liking it is actually an option. Yeah.
It's a very different kind of vibe. Yeah, that's a tough one to say. Yeah. You can respect it on a certain level, I guess.
You can find it interesting. Yeah, and you could connect with the some of the themes and elements of it. But like is a lot.
I really appreciated the writing. I respected his abilities. He had graphic and unforgettable moments. Did you like it? No. I don't think I would say I liked it. That's kind of how I felt about a book. It just went up for our Patreons. Anybody who gives us as much of a dollar gets to listen to my little ramblings about whatever the fuck book I'm reading.
Oh, what and, website is that? Is that patreon.com/pixelitpod?
That's the one. How did you just snap it off like that?
I don't know. I think, I think the Pale told me, I think I got
the
an
Pale
echo.
Must have told you.
I think I got an echo of a Pale memory.
That must have been what it was.
That's probably it. Yeah.
yeah. And so a review of a book I read not long ago went up there a couple of weeks back, called The Laws of the Skies, which is basically a French, it's like a modern French Lord of the Flies situation with a bunch of literal 6-year-olds going into the woods with 3 adults to do a camping trip, and nobody gets back alive.
Wow.
And and I respected what the writer was getting at. I admired his writing. I thought it was incredibly well written. I respected the story and the plot and the meaning behind it and the message, and it ruined my life. I am so unhappy that I read that book.
I get it.
Especially now that I have a son. It's extra fucked.
It's like, I am unhappy about this, but I'm glad I read it.
So good.
I'm glad I read it, but I don't like it. 5 out of 5 stars.
No. you know what? Pretty much it. Yes. Yes. I do not like it. Please never stop writing. You are a treasure.
Ten out of ten will be traumatized again.
Yeah. 10 out of 10. I'm going to bury my copy in the backyard and, you know, put several vigils over it in hopes that a zombie monster doesn't crawl out of its ashes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
I don't think that's an unfair comparison to make with Sacred and Terrible Air. I don't. Yeah.
So if you want to hear more about Phil's little reviews, patreon.com/pixelitpod, where you can see those. You can get ad-free versions of the episodes. I don't even know if the ads, I'm putting ad breaks in, don't know if they're making it, but I'm doing it anyway. So when those ads start rolling, you would appreciate having the ad-free feed.
Exactly.
So ad-free bonus episodes when we actually get around to making bonus episodes. And at the highest level, $10, you get a shout out. So this is the part of the show where I shout out our best patrons. Actually, I shouldn't call them the best patrons. We love all of our patrons equally. But the best patrons at
$10. We just love
you more. We just love you a little bit more.
You are our favorite children.
You're our favorite children.
Obviously.
Oh, don't worry, Harry. I love you at a pound a month. You know, that's great.
Especially because you get to say the word pound in that context. Feels so
pounds. He has he pays in pounds. But yeah, thank you so much to Ruthless Mutter, Kyle Seaman, Jesus Loves You, and Friendly Friend.
Friendly Friend, the OG.
The OG, Friendly Friend. Friendly Friend is our
original donator.
Yeah. Friendly Friend is our Cameron Ladd. If you've ever listened to the No Clip podcasts, Danny's always shouting out Cameron Ladd, who has been at the top tier for, I think, the longest of anybody. So he always goes, Cameron Ladd, or something like that.
I love it.
So I would love Friendly Friend to be our Cameron Ladd. Backslash Patreon ad read end.
It's good.
Let's good. Put this sacred body into the terrible marsh.
Let's do.
This ain't reality TV.
Picking up with chapter 9. Chapter 9 is called Sacred and Terrible Air, and it's a loose conceptualization of what the religion of the world is like. And it's based on a recurring motif of someone who reappears throughout different times in history with names such as Pius of Paracarnassus, Erno Pasternak, or Dolores Day. To be honest, I'm not sure I fully understand what was going on in this chapter. But it seems like the Messiah of this world is discussion, is like what happens when the world believes in nihilism and a pale sweeps over the continents.
We're going to talk a lot about nihilism in this section, too. So
yeah, there's a lot of nihilism going on. You might say that's the theme of the book is generally nihilism.
Pretty much.
Don't be afraid of anything, Donnie. They're cowards. Fucking nihilists.
This guy's gonna hurt us, Walter.
Chapter 10, Good Night, Ani. Jesper comes home to see that the place has been freshly cleaned and that Therese's bedroll and vomit bowl is gone. So this chapter is weird because this is a flash forward to start the chapter. And then it goes back. It's like, I will say, of all the narrative decisions, I am usually able to follow where he is. This part was just like, why are we flashing forward without any not, like, there's no, you don't know why, like, that they have flashed forward at this point. So it just becomes what follows gets confusing.
It starts out tough enough with following, going back, going forward, going back, going forward. And it only gets worse as it goes on.
Yeah.
It only gets tougher. So,
So he's watching his girlfriend, Anita, sleep. The age gap between them is problematic. She is 19 and he's 34, but she was 15 when they started dating.
Yes. That's fine. Sure.
Great. Jesper wakes her up because he needs to get at something under the bed. And he tells her that he's leaving right now and needs to pack some stuff together. He tells her that he's going to disappear to continue his path for looking for the Lund girls. She mentions about a time when he talked about the Lund girls at her parents' cabin when he got drunk. The girl's name is Anita, by the way, but he calls her Ani.
Yes. She just kind of goes with it.
She just rolls with it. Yeah. Jesper tells Anita that she should just take his apartment and then try to sell off his property in the city center because property values are going to drop soon. Anita calls him a pedophile, because of his obsession with the Lund girls and says she's not staying at his place. He retorts with a line about her working in an ammo factory in Grodd. They continue to argue until Jesper drops a truth bomb on her. Her home, Revachol, has been destroyed by a big bomb. And her sister was in Revachol at the time. This changes things. Anita begs him not to leave, but he leaves anyway. And he gets into a taxi with Therese and it drives off. We cut to 7 days earlier. Immediately following the Zaum incident with Derek Trentmuller. They are speeding away towards Jesper's place, even though he knows that his girl from Revachol will be visiting soon. Therese's memory is jumbled again, and he's drifting back and forth between his memories and that of Trentmuller and Vidkun Hurd. Therese flashes back to the funeral of the Lund girls and how Authority used found bones to identify the bodies of the girls. In his haze, Therese remembers a doctor coming by to inject saline into him on back-to-back nights, and also a news report about the collapse of the Northern Passage because of the Pale. He believes at this point they will never know what happened to the Lund girls. Anita arrives at the apartment. Khan has wildly inappropriate thoughts when finding out that Jesper is dating her, going on and on about her tits in his head.
It is so weird. And I like Khan.
But there's this weird little injection about what his thoughts are when he sees
her. His thoughts are literally like boobs, boobs, boobies. Like, it's so uncomfortable. I mean, we've all done it.
He's just saying tits, 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 tits. Show me your tits. And it's like, oh, Khan, buddy. Okay. Or Robert, we didn't actually need to see inside of Khan's head right at this point.
Yeah, that was that one. I question a lot. Yeah.
They say that Therese is suffering from food poisoning. Khan makes his exit, and Anita talks about how it's weird that they're here, and she doesn't remember Jesper ever mentioning his school friends. She goes to the bedroom and sees the small ring box on his table. On his bedside table and gets excited for a moment. And she opens it.
She forgets everything.
Womp womp. Meanwhile, in Vasa, ICP agents are looking for Therese and go to the police station where he had been arrested 4 days prior. Elsewhere, Khan is holding his model of the Haran Kor like a baby. For those of you not watching the video version, I just shrugged. Because that's what happens. I don't know.
That's it.
That's it. And then Therese emerges from his cocoon and has tea with Jesper. Meanwhile, at a nearby cafe, someone nearly chokes on their coffee when they see an ad that has been published in the newspaper. It's the Malin Lund's letter of her saying that she is okay and she is with the man. And at the bottom, the ad requests any information regarding the Lund girl's kidnapping. So I just imagine this in like Robert Stack's voice. Yeah. It's like the end of Unsolved Mysteries of You or anyone you know happen to know that any information about the disappearance of the Lund girls, please call 1-800-UNSOLVED.
This is the Estonian Unsolved Mysteries, though. So it's extra fucked. God, that show is so good.
Yeah,
that theme was the original X-Files theme, by the way.
Yeah,
like that theme song that would like just strike terror into your heart without even knowing a thing about what was about to happen.
You know what? Would unnerve me is the theme to Mystery on PBS.
I don't remember that.
Oh, we gotta play that. We got to look that up. Let's see. Mystery PBS intro.
Mystery.
Let's see
mystery
here.
Mystery intro.
Let me share this. So on the stream, on the recording, so we can.
Everyone can enjoy it.
Everyone can enjoy it because I think it's necessary. Share. Screen, and there we go. Share, and
that's some Edward Gorey shit.
It is Edward Gorey. Yeah,
nice.
Can you hear that?
Mystery is made possible.
Oh,
nope. Even YouTube freaked out.
Mystery is made possible by a grant from Mogul Corporation.
Oh, that's the scariest thing of all. I mean, yeah. Oh, Vincent Price, fuck yeah.
Yeah, okay, baby.
Yeah, that's absolutely worth a little bit of chill in the bones. That's that's a
lot.
It
scared the shit out of me as a kid. And so for those who don't see it, I don't even know if I'll be able to show it on the screen, but it's a animation by Edward Gorey, who used to do these cartoons. Like, Edward Gorey did animation in this, or cartoons in the style of like Adam's Family, but they were actually unnerving and terrifying. Like, they would just be like a woman looking sad, holding a carriage, and then she would walk to the edge of a cliff and push the carriage over.
Yeah,
that's it. No punchline.
That's all.
Woman
thing.
Just murders her baby. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Some genuinely fucked stuff. It's yeah.
It was like,
just upsetting. It's like, there's no cleverness. There's no, you know, morbid humor. It's just upsetting. That's it. That's it.
That's it. That's all it is. But you know, So Edward Gorey falls into that category, I think, of 5 out of 5.
Mm-hmm.
Don't like it.
Oh, yeah. Don't like it. Thank you for all your hard work, Mr. Gorey. Yeah.
So at the end of the chapter, we get a scene with a man named Ulv. And he buys out a store supply of cigarettes and alcohol, as well as a bunch of sausage, while everyone else in the area is evacuating. And leads us to chapter.
This sounds like me in grad school. Like this, I was all like, yeah, the world's like, yeah, burning around me.
I'll take 3 cartons and that big bottle. And you got any smoked sausage back there?
Yeah, and any cured meat whatsoever that you have. Just kidding.
It leads into chapter 11, where we are going to learn a lot more about Ulv, titled Self Chiller. We hear this. I love this.
Yes.
We hear the story of Ulv, who even as a little kid was too cool to hang out with other kids. He doesn't talk to his parents, actually, and he only talks when he's alone. Ulv is self chilling. We cut to Khan. Khan says he's in charge now, and he's talking about how he never really believed in a criminal solution to their problem. Khan and Therese talk about how they collect knickknacks and criminals respectively because they think it will lead them to more information about the girls. Jesper says he doesn't collect anything. Therese is not 100% sure that Derek didn't do it, and also points out that the Zaum machine is not admissible in court for this reason. It's not tried and true. Khan leads the other two through the woods, and isn't being forthright in his plan for fear that they'll say no. He does mention that he put an ad in the newspaper with Malin's letter, though. They get to an overlook, and Khan mentions that they're going to consult with the self-chiller. Jesper laughs at the idea, but Khan mentions it's the self-chiller that found bodies after 500 years missing with his methods. Jesper says he can't go because he has a design conference and mentions that going to Lemminkäse is not a good idea right now. We get more from Ulf's childhood. Ulf is only interested in music, and he is so hardcore. All the kids think he's so hard.
He's so hard. How is he so hardcore?
And we get a little weird interstitial mixing Ulv and Khan's childhoods. Khan is praying for Malin to like him back. It also mentions that Jesper sold his collection of adventure novels to help pay for the cherry speed that the girls wanted. Khan and Therese are driving into the zone of entropinetic collapse. They're being driven by a madman named Kenny, who wants to set a record for driving there. He's a rally car driver. As they're driving, trees are already starting to be uprooted and pulled into the sky, as well as houses. Most folks are fleeing Lemminkäs while they are driving towards it. While they're driving, Therese mentions that he's not with the ICP anymore. Khan tells him he knows because he's been using fake papers at every checkpoint on the drive.
It's not generally something the cop has to do.
And this scene is funny because like they're all Therese and Khan are in the back seat of the car getting drunk. And then like Kenny is like drinking as well. And they're like, shouldn't you not be drinking? And he's like, nah, it's fine. It makes me a better driver.
Yeah, he's one of those guys.
It's one of those guys.
One of those fucking guys. Guys, don't. I know our listeners are super smart and you would never go in for that. That guy is a liar. That guy who told you that, we all know that guy, and he's lying to you.
He's lying.
Yeah. And if you're the one who tells other people that, I'm looking you in the eye right now and calling you a liar.
Stop it.
Just don't.
Stop it.
Get hammered and get someone else to call you, get you a ride home.
Just that's damn straight.
Be an adult.
We flash back to 2 years ago when Khan received a phone call from a child's voice who told him terrible things and made him cry. I don't understand what it is. Is that supposed to be Malin or?
Yeah, I guess I was. That's another. There are lots of these little interstitials that I'm just kind of like, what is this? What are we doing? What's happening?
Yeah,
it certainly progresses like the weird atmosphere of this world. But I wonder sometimes at the actual plot.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Chapter 12, Ziggy. who is another interesting character. We get some background on Ziggy, the drug dealer. This is 19 years ago. One time Khan saw him write graffiti on the front of the school that said the whole world is a zone of imminent entropinetic catastrophe. Ziggy's a bad boy. He's repeated in 10th grade twice. His mother is friends with the Lund girl's mother. Ziggy is a nihilist and communist when necessary. He's also one of those kids that's super influential who gets other kids to ask their parents really awkward questions. there's something about like he convinced a girl to ask her dad about why social democracy doesn't work. And communism is the only true answer.
Why don't we have a nice communism, father? It's like, God damn. You just imagine him tearing his hair out.
Ziggy has theories about the Pale, how it's all the memories of the world and it's sweeping over everything and the collapse will happen in their lifetime. And in this scene that he's talking about this, he's telling it to a little kid. Yes. He's just like, there's a little boy and he's like, listen, if you're lucky, it's going to happen during your lifetime.
Won't that be fun?
And he, she ensures the little kid that even though it's the end of the world, it will be the peak of humanity.
Yeah.
Ziggy was also
I'm sure that subtlety was lost on that kid. I'm sure.
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah.
I'm sure the kid just didn't appreciate the luck of all of that.
Yeah. It's sort of like, to be like, by the way, in your lifetime, a meteor is going to destroy the world.
Yeah, you're going to be a part of the apocalypse. Isn't that fun? Like, isn't no, fun? I'm six.
There's a date. Here's a date for you. It's going to happen.
Yeah. Write that down.
Try
to remember it. Yeah.
Ziggy was also an accomplished rapper. Then he gets expelled from school because he was a drug dealer and sent to live with his father in Grodd. You're like, and by the way, you liking this Ziggy kid? Interesting, fascinating character.
Fascinating character, right?
Fascinating yeah. character. A few years later, his charred body is found in an incinerator.
I'm going to tell you straight up, this is my favorite chapter in the book. I love it. It's like a 5-page interstitial, and I love this chapter. Because I said last episode, I think the thing that this guy does that works for me so well is he creates very vivid characters. And yes. this character, I think we all knew this guy. I knew this guy. You knew this guy. And when we were that age and we would just thought they were the smartest, most insightful, intelligent human being alive. And you'll still think of that person and you'll go, whatever the fuck happened to that guy? Because
yeah,
he's an idiot and I'm an idiot. And right. I was, of course I fell for that and everything. And you rarely get to find out that it's anything more satisfying than, oh, he's in an MLM or something like that. Or, you know, it's like, yeah. you never find out about the charred body behind.
Right. Right. He's like, crypto bro. No. Ziggy died.
Oh.
Yeah. And his body was burned in an incinerator.
Yeah. Yeah. Womp, womp. Like just, I love this chapter. So it progressed almost nothing. And I loved it. It was such
just
a great
background
story.
On the guy who sells them the cherry speed.
That's it. And it's great because he's a true believer. He absolutely. And if you were ever into drugs at any point, you also knew this guy who would like sell you something and then he'd just hang out and you just like, just please leave. I just don't want you to, you're not. Now I would like to do drugs and I don't necessarily want you to be here. And he's like, but are you sure you don't want to talk about the battle for Blair Mountain or something? You know, and you're like, thanks. I just want to cozy up with this. And it's
like
this guy is so real.
The dealer starts talking about like conspiracy theories. He's like, right, hey, right. man, you know, it's like, you know what the Bilderberg group is? And we're like, please don't need to know anything more about you.
Yeah. I need you to go. That guy is either a drug dealer or he is a late night Uber driver. It's yeah. always your Uber driver from a concert you went to or a bar that went a little late and it's 2 a.m. and you're driving home and he just starts talking to you about the birds don't exist and shit like that. And it's
birds aren't real, man.
Birds aren't real. And you just have to sit there and go, uh-huh, because your life is in his hands.
Yeah.
And our economy is thriving.
This reminds me of we were doing this, April and I, when we first met, she was doing this leadership course in the county that she was living in at the time, Martin County, which is a very conservative county in Florida. It's like just north of Palm Beach. So Palm Beach County is pretty, it's pretty blue. And then sure. right up from Palm Beach is Martin County, which is hard red. Right. And I remember we were doing this thing where we're talking to business owners in Martin County. We're talking to this guy so Obama was president at the time, Obama, was president and, soda. He's talking about us and be like, he seemed normal until he started talking about economics. And then he started talking about like, this is when like not too long. This is not too long after the banks had started collapsing. Right. Uh-huh. And he's like, it's all planned, man. It's all planned. Like Obama, he and the banks, and they're all working together, man. They're working together and I guarantee, you know who? So Bank of America, they're the next ones up. They're going to collapse. And he's like going into this weird, it's like he never really gets anti-Semitic with it, but you know,
yeah.
he's about to, if you let him talk any. Yeah.
You give him any more time and he's going to tiptoe right up to that line and sneeze.
He's going
to
be like, he's going to go globalists. He's going to George Soros and like, I know where this is going. Ironically ironically, Bank of America was one of the only banks that didn't actually fall apart in that whole thing.
Right. But I'm sure he had a perfectly logical explanation for why that was. Why that particular prediction didn't work out in his favor.
Oh God. So anyway, where were we? Oh yeah, Ziggy. Ziggy is that guy.
He's that guy. Yeah.
We got one more chapter left, but it's a doozy. So before we go into that chapter, we're going to take a quick break for some products and services. We're back. All right. So chapter 13 is titled Matrimony, which is, there's actually a, did you see the footnote about this? There's a footnote in the book about how it's like the word that is used is actually like, it's like a made up portmanteau in another language, which is even harder to translate than like normal. Sure, yeah. So they did their best. They tried their best.
that's the key to translation. There's not always going to be a one-to-one kind of thing. So you have to use your discretion. I mean, that's great.
They just put in a footnote, be like, we tried.
we did our best.
So chapter 13, it is 20 years ago. Again, the boys are waiting for the girls on the train platform. Jesper has 24 speed pills that he bought from Ziggy. Therese has beer. The boys talk about how chicks hate beer and that it smells like piss, but Therese thinks it's still necessary. They wait sitting on the bench with their flowers in hand. The girls arrive and they look stunning. It's like cut back and forth between these girls arriving. And it's like, you know, because they are the daughter of a former supermodel, I think is like kind of the thing. And they're like, the wind is always blowing their hair back and it's cutting back to the boys who are just like, you know,
it's truly every, I mean, that's the thing though. That's how I remember it being though. When you're that age, they do this in movies all the time. Your coming of age movies where the girls are pretty and look nice and they're well, you know, put together and everything. And the boys are just schlubby kind of, but that is how it was. to quote Dana Gould, we were not raised. We were housed. And that's just, I'd love to be annoyed at things like that, where it's like, oh, come on. But that's honestly how I remember it. So
this
guy continues to be good at that nostalgia.
Yeah, exactly. He really hits that. I mean, he's around our age, I think, right? He's so he really hits that. This is what it was like.
Yeah. It's good to know that in a completely different country, things really aren't that different when it comes to this shit. That's pretty cool.
More of the same.
Yep. Pretty much.
Present day, we cut to present day. Kenny, Therese, and Khan arrive at the self-chiller's house. Kenny parks the car so it's ready to take off when they're done. When Khan and Therese enter the house, it seems like no one is there, and they make their way through a maze of rooms. And they realize that the building is an old discotheque. And then they find the self-chiller, who is like, he's ready to drop a beat. And he's like, don't ruin my intro. So Khan just places the envelopes on his monitor that they need him to look into, and they just back away. And then suddenly the music makes things seem like they were 80 years ago, or I guess not the music, but the influence of the Pale is starting to like do some weird warped shit. Makes it seem like things were. Yeah, fucking with them. It seems like things are 80 years ago and they're seeing like when Krasmazov was killed. Meanwhile, Jesper is standing in one of the Havsanglar hotel rooms practicing fake answers for what happened at the design conference and what happened in Lemminkäis. So he has to lie to his friends that he was at the design conference, and he has to lie to Anita what was going on in Lemon Kai's, I think is kind of like the where things are, right? He's like practicing right. two sets of lies. And while yeah. he continues to explain who the self-chiller is as a practice answer, he walks around the room and he's trying to observe what Derek Trentmuller saw that day. And then he leaves the hotel room and he goes down to the beach and he considers walking into the ocean. And he's just like observing surfers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We cut to 20 years ago and the Lund girls and the friends are set up in the woods to party. Therese has slipped into a bad mood because Charlotte didn't hug him and is thinking of a genocide that happened to his people.
Yeah. Yeah. Won't let it go.
Come on, buddy.
Yeah, this is where he goes when he's in a bad mood. He thinks about a genocide. Like, Jesus.
They begin passing out the drugs and Charlotte mentions that it's important to stay hydrated while on it. Charlotte is very mom mode in this scene. Like, she is like, I am the oldest drug user here. I'm telling you how to handle your high.
It's and I think at one point one of them she says, like, what do you think? And one of the guys goes, I think there are bank robberies that are less planned than what's going on right now. This is like, it's such a great line. It's because she's being such a control freak about everything. It's like, come on, man, let's just do some drugs, please.
And she's like, everybody gets one.
Yeah.
Therese thinks about what Ziggy said when they bought the drugs from him, how good the drug is and how it's better than all the others. He's talking about Ziggy's like, yeah, man, you know, nose candy, fuck that shit. You know, pop is like talking about all these other drugs. Like, this shit is the real deal. He is basically like Eric Stoltz's character from Pulp Fiction talking about the heroin that he is selling.
That is exactly it. And he's like, it's like, this is the only like truly communist drug. Like, it's they get it over there and they bring it through the pale. And it's like, he's telling you about everything, a little aspect of it. It's like, you know, these are teenagers, right? They don't know shit.
Listen, I don't fuck around with this non-premium shit. This is premium shit. This is premium. Right. This is pure communism as a drug, man. What are you not getting? I don't think I'm going to sell it to you now. At one point, he says, I'm not going to sell it to you
now. Yeah. Yeah. Like, whoa, 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 hold on.
And it's Ziggy continues to be one of my favorite characters.
The best, just seriously, the best part of this book, as far as I'm concerned.
It's funny because in the first half of the book, his name pops up a couple times. For like whatever reason. And then in the second half, when he's an actual character, you're like, oh, I see why this random drug dealer that went to school with them is somewhat important in the story. Yeah.
I see why he warranted a mention earlier. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Creating characters is Robert Kurvitz is really fucking good at creating characters.
That's which makes a lot of sense when you consider this is a TTRPG thing.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. I love it. I love it. His characters are A1.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So he calls the drug. He's like, the girls call it Cherry Speed. I call it matrimony, the matrimony of matter. And this is where it had like the the little note and like literally translated. It's like the marriage of drugs or something like that for the word that they used in the original language. So Malin took two. She said she took two, much to Charlotte's dismay, and the drug begins affecting all of them. For Malin, it makes her think that she is pregnant. We see that there are 12 pills left, and we find out that Malin did not take two. She took six.
Six. Six.
And they all wait as the drugs begin to affect them. Meanwhile, in present day, Jesper is standing alone on the beach wearing a wetsuit, and he enters the water. It's very cold, and within 45 minutes, hypothermia will begin. He continues pushing into the water with his surfboard. Back 20 years ago, Therese is trying to get a better handle on what it will feel like, and Charlotte and Ani are trying to convey to them what it's like. Khan and Malin separate from the group and sit together, and Khan begins talking about things again, and Malin says she likes hearing him talk. She likes hearing him just his, like, I'm very smart shtick.
Doing his, and what does he ever, she like gives him a really nice compliment, and he goes, and you have very nice posture.
Yeah. Like,
it's just the most standard pseudo intellectual white guy kind of thing. Like, yeah, it's just like, you know, you have value as well. I know I'm a big smarty pants, and you have very shiny hair. Like, oh my God.
I like it. I like the choice of hair conditioner that you use.
Right. Yeah. That's the same.
That's it's absolutely the same.
God damn it, dude.
Yes. Well, Khan's not a white guy. He's supposed to be Indian, like relative. Okay, to,
fair enough. Fair enough.
But still,
but he's, the point but he's stands, pulling a he's, white guy move.
He's pulling a real white guy move here.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a deeply white guy move.
Then she begins having a hot flash and asks Charlotte to pull her dress off because she is overheating. Malin's having a bit of a bad trip at first. And then she seems like she's having a good one. And she's connecting deeply with Khan, and they're cuddling together and letting the world vibrate around them. Mm-hmm. Present day, Khan and Therese make their way out of the manor, and Kenny is glad to see them because shit is getting weird. Tiles are floating off the roof of the house and then come back down. Snow has stopped. Like, they're just hanging in the air. Snow is just hanging in the air now. As they make their way to the car, there's like this deafening beat drop that goes boom, like from the house. So it's like this techno music. And it's just like, and they look back in horror as it's like rattling the window panes. Yeah.
It's like, so much chaos.
Much happening in the press. In the past, Therese is dancing and his mood is totally changed. Malin, though, is now on back to having a bad trip. She's having trouble now from the amount of pills that she took.
I wonder. Sure.
Yeah. She's having trouble keeping cool. Somewhere in the pale, Frantichek the Brave tells Adia Harancourt that the world still has 8 years left and anything can happen.
Yep.
The party continues in the past. Ani and Khan are tending to Malin while Charlotte continues dancing half naked in front of Therese while telling everyone to stay hydrated.
I love it.
Therese thinks
that is also incredibly relatable. Like, that's absolutely, yeah. I've been to that party.
Keep drinking water, people.
Yeah. Therese, dance over here.
Therese thinks about the first time he met Charlotte at school. He was wearing his school uniform like a dork because it was his first day at the new school, and he like didn't know that you were given a school uniform. You're not supposed to wear it. Otherwise, you look like a loser. And he sees Charlotte that first day, and she's beautiful, and she's hanging around with her, like, her best male friend who is also beautiful. He's like Handsome Andy or something like that in the book. I forget what his name is.
Yeah. It's literally like Handsome Dan or some goddamn thing. Yeah.
But yeah, that's the first time he's like thinking back to the first time he ever saw Charlotte. Present day, Khan and Therese watch as the destructive nature of the pale rips the world apart beyond where the house stands. They all get in the car. Therese believes that the whole area will be pale within the next half hour. In the past, Khan is telling the tale of the killer waves to Jesper, Ani, and Malin. And how math of the smaller waves meeting each other works out to create the massive waves. And then he explains how the similar math can be used to calculate the movement of the pale. Present day, in Charlotte's y'all. Jesper is on a surfboard and he sees a killer wave and he's paddling to try to get on top of it. In the past, Jesper and Anya have paired off to talk more. Jesper never quite got the hive the others did from the pills. Anya takes one and shows him how to snort it because that might help him feel it better. She's like, oh, no, sometimes you just got to, snort it. She's like, it'll hit you faster, but it'll end faster, too. Present day, Jesper is on the wave surfing, but the wave begins to collapse. And Jesper thinks about how this cluster of memories that he holds on to makes him impossible for the world to support. Like, I hear you, man.
Yeah. Damn. Right there. Absolutely. Been there. Yeah.
I've been there. Yeah, man. Elsewhere, Khan looks up at Ulv's house, which is now floating in the air. They expect it to be ripped to shreds by the pale, but the pale stops. Ulv comes to the doorway and throws down the envelopes and tells them they have to go now. The pale begins moving again, destroying everything in its path. Ulv sits inside his house. The only trace of the Lund girls is in the memory of Jesper right now. Kenny outside drives as fast as possible as the pale continues to chase them. Khan looks at the papers inside and says, I was right all along. In the past, Ani and Jesper return with a big thing of water to everyone's delight. They all drink. Khan is riding on Therese's shoulders, pretending he's a robot. And they all run across the beach and into the ocean, and they float together in the water looking up at the stars. And Malin says, I don't know when I read this is like, damn, that line hit me. She says about the stars, they are no longer there, but I still see them. The next morning, the group wakes up and the boys take the girls to the tram station. They make plans to see each other in August after the Lund girls' family trip to Grodd. They're awkward but cute with each other as they say goodbye. It's the last time they see each other. End of chapter.
It's just such a... I don't fully know how much I like this book in terms of its plot and even sometimes the world and stuff like that. I love, however, the way that he makes me feel with his characters and with, in particular, that nostalgic thing, because it is taking what has been examined in high school movies and books and stuff for generations and upping the ante by saying that was the summer I fell in love with so-and-so and then we all went away and we all got jobs and got married. It's like no, we had that summer together and then they fucking died.
Yeah.
And no one ever saw them again, let alone us.
Right.
So it explains the obsession of their adult lives. And that to me, I will follow this book as it goes, simply based on the fact that he is able to keep me enthralled to these characters the way
they, they were with these girls. They had this magical summer with them. It's implied, but never specifically stated that they all lost their virginity together to the Lund girls. It's kind of like, and then that's it. That's the last time they see them is that night, is that morning.
Yeah.
After the sleepover in the woods,
Walk them to the train and that's it forever.
Forever.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's.
And I think that's the thing that a lot of stories that have that's and then we all grew up and that was the last time we saw each other type of thing is that I don't think those stories necessarily always deliver the hammer blow of the pain. So there is a scene in Mad Men that I love to reference because I think it's probably some of John Hamm's finest work as an actor. It's a scene where he is demonstrating this photo wheel to Kodak, right? Mm-hmm. And he gives this beautiful speech on nostalgia, right? and he's talking about how he knew this Greek ad copywriter at his old job and named Teddy. And Teddy would talk about nostalgia, and Teddy would say in Greek, it's nostalgia is it's not just looking back fondly, but it's the pain of remembering. It's mm-hmm. like the pain of an old wound. It's the pain of remembering. It's not just like looking back fondly. And I think I always think of that moment as like when a lot of people are writing nostalgically about things that happened. So they won't balance the good out with the pain of it can never be again.
Yes.
And absolutely. I think a lot of stories really fail to hammer that as hard as possible. Because this is the end of that summer story. It's not the end of the book, right? We still have more book to go. This is like the second third of the book, but that's the end of their story together. And I think ending it that way, they got on the train, it's the last time they see each other, really did hit that home. It hit that nostalgia. It hit the pain of remembering that scene. That despite how good it was, it could never happen again. So like just even remembering it is a bringer of pain.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. He nailed it. He absolutely nailed it.
Yeah.
And
I think, you know, obviously we have the pail doing its thing in this chapter, mm-hmm. which is just like a weird quirk of this world.
Right. And that's what I mean, where it's just like, it's kind of funny because it's like that is fascinating. That is interesting. And I'm, as a reader, so taken in just by this, you know, virgin suicides kind of thing, that they're like, oh, and the pail's coming and it's ripping everything apart. And it was just like, I don't really care.
Pail feels a little bit like a hat on a hat.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. This is coming from a guy who writes genre fiction, but the genre add-ons I do not care about in this book. Anytime he gets sci-fi fantasy about it, I don't care. It doesn't fascinate me on that level.
Yeah, his strengths are character. Like, absolutely. Full stop, his strength is character.
And what's interesting is I think, because we talk about adaptation on this show a lot, and I think that this is probably one of the best examples of why a certain piece of it worked as a game and a certain piece of it worked as a book, and never shall the two meet, pretty much. Yeah. It's that revolutionary stuff, that weird communist versus fascist kind of like speculative fiction Soviet era shit is so good in the game. The atmosphere, it bleeds into everything. And I think partially because it's a visual medium.
Sure.
And so it's impossible to avoid. And that's fucking great. It's one of the reasons that people think so fondly on Disco Elysium's aesthetic.
Right.
And its themes and whatnot. It's kind of distracting in this. But the story, the meat of this obsession with these girls from your childhood, the pain of nostalgia and all that is excellent. And is harder to pull across in a game, I think.
Right.
Some games have done it.
Yeah.
Night in the Woods comes to mind.
Sure.
I feel, you know, stuff like that. But I think it's far more appropriate in a book in this case. So I'm starting to see why maybe this book didn't get picked up. Well, it did get picked up, but I don't know.
It only sold 1,000 copies.
It feels to me like a self-published thing, but
I don't know. I don't know what the public. I mean, it's like probably just a small press in Estonia,
probably. Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know much beyond that, so I can see I can see why it might have gotten middling reviews or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But the book, I mean, I like it, but.
Yes, that's pretty much my stance.
There's some issues, and we'll finish it up next week. We'll ride that pale wave to the end of the book.
You guys get that?
Get it?
Pale.
It's a pale wave.
We have fun.
We're pale riders.
We're pale riders.
call me Clint Eastwood because I'm a pale rider.
Pale rider. We have a good time on this.
We
do. Show.
We have fun here.
We have fun.
So, Phil, I only have one question for you.
Please.
What are you playing?
Oh, there's only one game for me these days. I can't stop playing Pacific Drive. It has been between that and the card game that shall not be named, just constant, because it's, I don't know. I was telling Kevin this before we got started that I think the fascinating thing for me about Pacific Drive is it is a survival game, crafting game, all that stuff that I have not traditionally gone in for. I don't care for most of those because they leave you very rudderless, and I need some direction with my video games. It's very rare that I can pick up a video game and it just goes, well, just play. And I can go, oh, I'm painting a world. I'm not that guy. I need a little more than what those type of games generally give you.
Sure.
And this is it. The world they're the world they've created is mysterious and very fun to explore. The characters are interesting. The story's interesting, and it happens to have a huge crafting element to it.
Sure.
And it works. There's something just so wonderful about the way it balances. This is absolutely a game of the year contender for me. And it falls right into what I was saying before as a new dad, how games now need to have chunks that I can just bite out of here and there. And this is like that. This is a thing where I was like, okay,
it's chunky.
I got an hour. I can hop in here and go and explore this one section of the map and add some stuff to the logbook. And I need more chemicals because I'm running out of, you know, fixin' solution or whatever it's called. I really enjoy that. I am having an absolute blast with this one. And that's it. That's the thing. I've just been playing this and Balatro and Darkest Dungeon on my Switch. I'm gonna do one level of the wield or whatever in Darkest Dungeon, or I'm gonna try to get the next
ship on
my
stake.
Red deck.
Yeah, this stake on this deck.
Yeah, that is where I am right now, and I am in this beautiful, just snake eating its own tail of these three games. And it's an
Ouroboros, if you will.
Yes, exactly. An Ouroboros of contentment, of old man gamer. And I don't know. I've never been more content in my gaming life, Kevin. I feel great. That's great.
You feel great.
I feel great. What are you playing, Kevin?
I am still just playing Disco Elysium. Because I mean, I'm playing Balatro on my Steam Deck before I go to bed at night. But aside from that, Disco Elysium has been my main squeeze recently. I am like 75% through my current playthrough of it. It reminds me of like there's so many moments in this game that just remind me like, fuck, this is so good. It's so good. And so, like, the Pale is part of Disco Elysium, but it is much less important, or you don't really need to, like, engage with the Pale subplot necessarily.
Right.
It's, like, not nearly as important as it is in Sacred and Terrible Air. So, but yeah, I think it's a great game. I love, you know, playing on different, I want to try another playthrough with, like, a completely different type of detective and just see where that goes.
Oh yeah.
Someone very punchy instead of, brainy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Especially with your main character who's such a mess. Like, you've got to get a punch. He's
such a mess.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome.
He is, yeah. You know, spoilers for Disco Elysium. You play as a guy who, after a particularly long 5 days of drinking, has forgotten everything about who he is. He is, there is nothing. I think that's the first line of the game.
Yeah. You're coming out of nothingness. Yeah.
There is nothing. Only warm primordial blackness.
That's right. That's right. And there.
As your ancient reptilian brain talks to you over a black screen, and you get, like, you're getting dialogue options of, like, nothing. Never. And your brain, your ancient reptilian brain goes, never, ever, ever, baby.
Yeah. 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 It, that game gets you into what the game is about. And I mean
right
that
off the
in
bat.
The sense of, like, right off the bat, but it's, like, not what the game's about, but what the game's about. If that makes sense. It's fantastic. It's great.
Yeah. And then your limbic system ruins it by pointing out that you have
a
head.
As it always does. it's always there to ruin everything.
But yeah, that's what I've been playing. Dragon's Dogma 2 releases tomorrow as of recording this. And
here we go.
Oh shit. You know what came out? You know what came out today?
What came out today?
You know what came out today? Alone in the Dark.
That's right. That's right. Pim did a review of it, right?
They were doing, I don't know if they did a review, but they did do a kind of like an early stream of it because they got a early copy. Yeah.
I'm
and
very intrigued.
They tweeted a little bit about it. Yeah.
Looks interesting. Looks interesting. Yes. I think I'm definitely going to give it a go. It's
a lot of
good games early in the year this year.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to have to check that out, I think.
Yeah.
Alone in the Dark, as we all know, is kind of the thing that, makes Resident Evil, a thing.
Oh, very much so. Very much a foundational,
it's a foundational survival horror title. Yeah, it's like,
absolutely.
It's like Alone in the Dark and Sweet Home are really important in that, in the building blocks. Aside from that, that'll do it for tonight's episode. If you want to hear more about us, follow us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Friendster, Angel Fire.
GeoCities.
Is GeoCities still around? Did they close that up?
I have no idea.
We should have a GeoCities page. We should have, if there is something.
That would be awesome, actually.
Actually, you know what? I think there's a fake, there's like a new version of GeoCities called NeoCities. Like, it's like supposed to. It's supposed to be like what GeoCities was back in the day. Oh God, yeah.
GeoCities officially kicked the bucket March 2019.
Yeah, so NeoCities. Maybe we should buy. We should get a NeoCities. It's free.
Why fuck not? I ask you. Why the fuck not? do it, baby.
Yeah, baby. So, yes, follow us on all those platforms with the exception of Pinterest, LinkedIn, Friendster, and MySpace.
Just most of them.
Most of them. Or Patreon, best place to follow us. That'll do it. We're all done. How are you? We've been doing all the talking. How are you guys? Late.
I feel like we've dominated the conversation.
We've really dominated the conversation. How are you?
How are you? Tell us.